exist and not be civilized off the face of the earth. Our own forests, not to hold the king's game merely, but for inspiration and our own true recreation. Thoreau foresaw man's need to reach out from the clutter of the mechanized age for a touch of the natural. And really, isn't that why we've all come here to Holden Village, for a touch of the natural? He proposed that each community sustain a primitive forest of 500 or 1,000 acres. Let us keep the new world new, he proposed, and preserve all the advantages of living in the country. And think of how wonderful it would be if each town, city, had as part of its backdrop or within its boundaries a primitive forest of 500 or 1,000 acres. Instead of slums, we'd have a setting of trees and flowers and nature as God made it. The problem has been that ever since the European came to America, the American earth was not simply a place to live, but a commodity with a price tag, just as it is today. The earth is real estate. And it grieves me to report that George Washington, among others, was highly regarded for his land promotions throughout the Virginia colony. And even the humble pioneers were concerned with subduing wilderness, reducing it, as they said, to possession. So the earth, instead of belonging to all creatures, became private property. Nevertheless, there were people early on, even before Thoreau, before John Muir, and before our time, early in the settlement of the New World, who concerned themselves with saving some wild nature. I don't know how many of you know the names of John Bartram and William Bartram. I don't see any recognition, so I'll tell you a little bit about them. John Bartram was born on a farm outside of Philadelphia in 1699. He was a farmer, a plowman, who became fascinated with the miracle of plants and wondered how many he had plowed under and how many blossoms he had destroyed without ever understanding their structures and their proper uses. So he studied the plants. He learned botany. Then he learned Latin. Do we have any botanists here? Wish we did. Good. Kent the botanist. He learned botany, then Latin, so he could read the works of Linnaeus. Linnaeus was the Swede who established a system of classifying plants, which we still use today. And John planted his fields with every seed he could lay his hands on. And he traveled all over the Northeast, then the mountains, Canada, and then he went south. And he took his son William Bartram along with him. John Bartram was a leading figure in his day in Philadelphia. He was a friend of Benjamin Franklin and other important people of that time. And he built a garden, a house and a garden on the back. Is anybody here from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania? He built his house and garden on the banks of the Schuylkill River, which is still there. The very stone house that he built, still there. And Bartram's garden is still there. The most important historic garden in America. And he took his son, William. William was a failure at everything he ever did, because all he wanted to do was work with plants, study plants, and be out in the woods. So John Bartram took William with him, hunting plants in the South. And John Bartram plucked a tree, a shrub, almost a tree, called the Franklin tree, named for Benjamin Franklin. Franklinia alatimaha. Probably the most famous lost species, because after they plucked it and planted it in Bartram's garden, after 1803, it was never found again in the wild, but it still grows and been propagated from Bartram's garden, the Franklin tree. So William Bartram then went traveling on his own in the South, principally in the South. I think it was 1773 to 1776, or 1776 to 1778, in that period, just about the time the Revolutionary War was breaking. And he recorded his adventures in a book called The Travels of William Bartram, which is one of the most wonderful books I have ever read, because it's a book of history, it's a book of adventure, it's a book of nature, it's a book of literature. And it's the beginning of ecology. He described the interdependence of natural creatures. The spider preying on a bumblebee, which had lit to feed on the leaf of a plant. A coachwhich snake wreathing itself around the body of a grounded hawk. The battle between crayfish and goldfish. The swarming assembly of alligators feeding upon a vast solid bank of fish. I'm sure they must have that book here, and if they have, you might look up The Travels of William Bartram. To Bartram, every little thing had personality, purpose, and beauty. He was a pantheist. He taught friendship even toward the rattlesnake, which, as he wrote, is never known to strike until he is first assaulted or fears himself in danger, and always gives the earliest warning by the rattles at the extremity of his tail. So that was William Bartram. He avoided involvement. He preferred the sanctuary of the gardens left by his father, and men beat a path to his door and sought him out through correspondence. One person who came to him was Alexander Wilson. Any ornithologist here? Bird watchers? Alexander Wilson is known as the father of American ornithology. So Bartram laid the foundation for what was to come, of people who followed: John J. Audubon, James Fenimore Cooper, the artists of the Hudson River School. What they did, what those people did, what Bartram and those other people who followed him did, they established another way of thinking about America, about the world, and about the universe. That it was not a commodity. That all life, all space, are sacred, without a price tag, a gift to us, for us to cherish and protect and preserve. One of these people was George Catlin, the artist. George Catlin painted all the Indians in their glory of their dress and their rituals. Catlin went further, proposing that large sections of the plains be preserved, as he wrote, in their pristine beauty and wilderness, in a magnificent park where the world could see for ages to come the Native American in his classic attire galloping his wild horses amid the fleeting herds of elk and buffalo. He wrote, "What a beautiful and thrilling specimen for America to preserve and hold up to view of her refined citizens of the world in future ages. A nation's car containing man and beast in all the wild and freshness of their natural beauty." And then came Ralph Waldo Emerson. Ralph Waldo Emerson was an optimist. I think Ralph Waldo Emerson, to my mind, was the great philosopher and the great teacher in American history, or the world history. Believing that evil is not a law, but a sickness. That humankind is essentially good. And that the human soul is capable of transcending the physical and material to reach the universal truths. That wilderness is the sanctuary of universal truths. That's the school of philosophy we call transcendentalism that you may know. And here's what he wrote in his essay on nature, which is undoubtedly one of the most important, and to my mind, works of any kind in American literature, in American history, in American philosophy, American conservation. "At the gates of the forest, the surprised man of the world is forced to leave his city estimates of great and small, wise and foolish. The knapsack of custom falls off his back with the first steps he makes into these precincts." Here we find nature to be the circumstance which dwarfs every other circumstance and judges like a god, all men that come to her. And again, in the spirit of Bartram, he expresses reverence for creation and belief in a mystical union with God through nature. And I quote, "To the poet, to the philosopher, to the saint, all things are friendly and sacred, all days holy, all men divine. For the eye is fastened on the life and slights the circumstance. Every chemical substance, every animal in its growth teaches the unity of cause, the variety of appearance." Now, Emerson spearheaded a philosophy, while his friend Thoreau devoted himself to living it. Thoreau lived as he wanted, rather than conforming in any of the socially accepted ways. He was a freak out, a hippie, whatever you want to call him, a nonconformist. But still, his outlook was positive and loving of all people. Here's what he wrote. "I do not propose to write an ode to dejection, but to brag as lustily as a chanticleer in the morning, standing on his roost, if only to wake my neighbors up." So his goal was to wake up his neighbors. E.B. White, the famous essayist and author, wrote about Alden's book, about Thoreau's book, Walden. He called it the best youth's companion written by an American. for it carries with it a solemn warning against the loss of one's valuables. It advances a good argument for traveling light and trying new adventures. It rings with the power of positive adoration. It contains religious feeling without religious images, and it steadfastly refuses to record bad news. Yesterday, we talked about wilderness as sacred space. That's the way I see it, and that's the way all of these people that I'm citing have seen it. It is a religious issue. It is a religious image. It does have religious feeling. Thoreau kept his life simple, flexible, and immediate, wary of possessions that might soon possess the possessor. Maybe we all long too much to live well. He observed, thought, and did for himself. For the most part, the citizens of Concord, Massachusetts, where he lived and where he died, unrecognized, were simply baffled by his propensity to spend an hour in the rain, lost in introspection over the sight of wild ducks on a pond, and yet he would count it a waste of time to engage in practical exercise. Nevertheless, Thoreau was probably the most industrious man at his calling. His view was plain, and I quote, "If a man walks in the woods for love of them half of each day, he is in danger of being regarded as a loafer. But if he spends his whole day as a speculator, shearing off those woods and making the earth bald before her time, he is esteemed as an industrious and enterprising citizen." As he insisted, this curious world which we inhabit is more wonderful than it is convenient, more beautiful than it is useful. It is more to be enjoyed than to be used. Now, Thoreau was also sensitive to the rights of man as well as nature. He was a nonviolent, civil disobedient. He went to jail based on his hatred of slavery and refusal to pay taxes to support the Mexican War, an expansionist scheme to acquire territory for the slave states. When he was in jail, his friend Emerson came to visit. And Emerson said, "Henry, what in the world are you doing in there?" And Thoreau looked at him and said, "What are you doing out there?" So he wrote his essay on the duty of civil disobedience, an outpouring of conscience explaining why he felt compelled to stand up against the state's immorality, whatever the cause. And the curious thing is that Gandhi read Thoreau, and then Martin Luther King read Gandhi, who had read Thoreau. So what goes around comes around. Thoreau saw unchecked profiteering set on a collision course that ultimately would devour all wild nature on this continent, perhaps on the entire globe, and he warned that some wilderness must be preserved. He really had no quarrel with civilization, but he defined wilderness as a necessary component to civilization. In wildness is the preservation of the world. That's the rose grape. In wildness is the preservation of the world. He warned against having every part of man cultivated, or to subject everything in man to rational and conscious control would be to warp, diminish, and barbarize him. And I think that's where we are now in our civilization. So too, the reduction of all nature to use for profit in due course would end in the dehumanization of human power. He said something else. He said, in wildness is the preservation of the world. But he also said, heaven is under our feet as well as over our hands. So we have, if we want, if we cherish it and protect it. He published only two books during his lifetime. He was like Van Gogh, you know, the artist Van Gogh sold one painting in his lifetime. His brother was his agent, he sold one painting for $24. But it didn't stop Van Gogh. He had faith in his work and belief, and he painted his work. And Thoreau, didn't he? He didn't even know he was writing for posterity. He was writing journals. So he wrote two books, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers and Walden. But his collected works, including his journal or day book, run to 20 volumes. He had neither dream nor hope nor design that Walden would ever be recognized for what it is, a classic in the true sense of the word. A work of elevated prose that has no date, that speaks simply, directly, and inspiringly of matters momentous to the individual who would love life in a soul-satisfying manner. Anyone approaching Thoreau with a degree of natural feeling will never again view nature as a thing wholly apart from oneself. His significance and influence have never been fully felt, not even now. But he's a valid guide and companion to the North Country. And in this book, the last chapter, I wrote about Thoreau in the Maine woods, and I went over some of the same, in the Allegheny Street. Hopefulness is spread across the pages with expressions like, in relation to the Maine woods. What a place to live, what a place to die and be buried in. There certainly men would live forever and laugh at death and the grave. Well, that's pretty neat. Now, if we have time, I want to talk a little bit about John Muir. But on the way, I'm just tracing some of these people who spoke out and were upset, tried to protest against the dehumanization of humankind as the American Earth was destroyed. And one of them was Charles M. Russell. Anybody know that name? Charles M. Russell was an artist in Helena, Montana, who started as a cowpuncher. He was a hunter and trapper, and he lived as a squaw man for a time with the Blood Indians. But once he started painting, nothing could stop him from recording the West with virtuosity, as he did. He was so prolific that he once painted the circular glassworks in the saloon at Great Falls, which is still there. And he painted more than 3,500 works, and his paintings are priceless today. Yet the more Russell saw trails plowed under, barbed wire strung, cities arise and the Indians pushed back and beaten down, the more he yearned for a time before his home. His heart was in the simplicity of wilderness. And you can see that in his great paintings of the buffalo hunts, showing the dead of winter, the dust of summer, and Indian personalities and all their dignity. And in the titles he gave, Before the White Man Came, When Great Herds Came to Drink, When the Land Was God's. And once Russell astounded an admiring group at Great Falls called the Forward-Looking Citizens, kind of a Chamber of Commerce deal, with an outburst of revulsion at the sham of profiteering society. And this is what he told me. I have been called a pioneer. In my book, a pioneer is a man who comes to a virgin country, traps off all the fur, kills off all the wild meat, cuts down all the trees, grazes off all the grass, plows the roots up, and strings 10 million miles of wire. A pioneer destroys things and calls it civilization. I wish to God that this country was just like it was when I first saw it, and that none of you folks were here at all. Well, you can imagine how they felt. I mean, he was a hero to those people because he was a celebrated artist and a really tremendous achievement. How are we doing on time? We have time. So, what? So we still have some time. If anybody has any questions or answers, just interject. So Russell expressed perplexity and distress at the destruction of wilderness. Thoreau struck out in its defense but functioned essentially alone. And then along came John Muir. He inspired a movement and an organization in a period of rising concern. John Muir was a long-bearded, long-legged, uncommon champion of nature and of his fellow men, who wrote, and I quote, "There is a love of wild nature in everything, an ancient mother love, showing itself whether recognized or not, and however covered by cares." Muir was born in Scotland, who's from Wisconsin? Do you know John Muir? Well, John Muir's father and family came to Wisconsin when he was about 11 years old. And that's where he grew up. And he enrolled for a time at the University of Wisconsin. So he left for the University of the Wilderness, as he quoted, and he walked 1,000 miles down to the sea. That's what George was doing, studying everything, recording it. I remember he wrote that he slept in the cemetery. He lived in Yosemite. He was a very popular writer. He didn't want to be a writer, but he wanted to tell people what it was that he loved and to encourage them to see it too. So he became a very popular writer. He lived more outdoors than indoors and described the mountain and landscape in terms of both science and poetry. And I'll read you just a few lines from John Muir. Vapor from the sea, rain, snow, and ice on the summit, glaciers and rivers. These form a wheel that grinds the mountains thin and sharp, sculptures deeply the flanks, and furrows them into ridge and canyon, and crushes the rock into soils on which the forests and meadows and fruitful vine and tree and grain are growing. So he had a way of looking at things in a manner that would be accepted by the scientist, but yet that he could express as a poet. And I'll show you something else that he wrote. This is in one of his famous incidents that he described. If it was raining, like Thoreau, he'd want to go out in the rain, feel the rain. Probably if there was an earthquake, he'd want to go out and feel the earth trembling. He'd get a message from deep in the earth, where he's standing on the trembling earth. So he climbed into a tree in the midst of a big windstorm. He wanted to connect with that tree. What's a tree going through in a windstorm? And he saw the winds caress the branches, bending them, as he wrote, in lusty exercise, stimulating their growth, plucking off a leaf or a limb as required, now whispering and cooing like a sleeping child, now roaring like the ocean, the winds blessed by the forests, forest by the winds, with ineffable beauty and harmony as the sure result. And here's what he wrote. We all travel the Milky Way together, trees and men. But it never occurred to me until this storm day, while swaying in the wind, that trees are travelers in the ordinary sense. They make many journeys, not extensive ones, it is true, but our own little journeys, away and back again, are only little more than tree wavings, many of them not so much. So I think that's pretty good. And that was John Muir. John Muir inspired the creation of Yosemite National Park in 1890. Who's been to Yosemite? Well, he didn't. And in 1892, he promoted the whole park concept through a new group called the Sierra. He established the Sierra, of which he remained president until his death in 1914. He fought resource exploitation, but still he wanted the national parks not to keep people out, but to make the wonders accessible. He called them the people's playgrounds. He objected to roads, but not to use. Now yesterday we had a little discussion about what people can do. One or two of our members of the group yesterday were kind of had a sense of futility. But I know. And one thing happened. Just yesterday I found the Sunday Seattle Times Post-Intelligencer here on page one of the Sunday paper is an article about a lady I know who's from Seattle. Holly Dyer, a fighter by nature, longtime conservation leader in the state, doesn't plan to slow down and retire. And here's what it says. If Polly Dyer hadn't moved to Washington in 1950, The state map might look a lot different today. No North Cascades National Park, no wilderness areas, for that matter, no Wilderness Act. Olympic National Park might not include the rainforest. Backpackers who hike the park's wild coastal strip, the longest road of this coastline in the lower 48 states, might share that shore with cars. Dyer played a big role in all those fights. She has been a leader in the state's conservation movement for more than four decades, since long before the word environmentalist was coined. If you think that as one small individual you can't make a difference, you haven't met Polly Dyer, says Darlene Maybelle. So there you go. She did. And it was so wonderful to read about her because she's a good friend of mine. And then I read on page 16, if I can find it in a hurry, page 22. About something we're going to do in a couple of weeks. Here it is. Oh yeah, here she writes about John Muir, or somebody does. She's retired. Dyer plans to spend the next few months archiving her papers. She works at the university. A reunion of conservationists who helped pass the Wilderness 1964 Wilderness Act is scheduled for early September in Missoula, and I'm going to be there with her. But she'll be back in Seattle in time to organize the next Wilderness Conference slated for early October, and I'll be there. And if anybody who wants to come, I think it's the first weekend in October at the Mountaineers. And isn't this great? Listen to this. John Muir founded the Sierra Club in 1893, says Dick Fiddler, club leader from Seattle. And most of the rest of us can't figure out how he did it without Polly. So that's pretty neat, and it shows what one person can do to save, help us save lives, or help us save the human race from itself. So I'm going to take a break now and see what questions or answers you may have, or comments. So feel free to comment. I should introduce Ken Dahl.
Jim Lear.
Oh, Jim. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were... Jim Lear is with the U.S. Forest Service. We're happy. I saw Ken just outside. You look like him. Jim is with the Forest Service. I'm happy to have him. So he has some questions about the Forest Service.
I just have a little comment.
You're a botanist. Yes, ma'am.
I have a little comment. We're from St. Louis where they had a great flood last year. And most of the damage was in the river bottoms and what should have stayed floodplains. And
right.
Now they're talking about returning it to floodplains and building in those areas.
And building in the areas?
Prohibit it.
Oh, prohibiting building.
Yeah, leave it like it should be. So that's a
glimmer of hope. Oh, there are many, many glimmers of hope.
It's too bad it takes a flood to bring those about.
That's sort of the American way. You know, I think Americans have a great capacity for doing things, but it seems to take a catastrophe to make people tune in. Yes.
I'm from BC.
Right. From and where?
Vancouver.
Yeah.
But you may know that there's a very large controversy right now between loggers and conservationists, and it's splitting the province badly.
Right.
And of course, we have all these loggers with all their logging trucks blocking highways and doing everything else, trying to preserve their job and way of life, and it's really tragic in a lot of ways. The argument, of course, is that in the long term, that their jobs are going to be eliminated anyhow. What are some of your comments about that?
Well, I teach at Western Washington University, and my students went up to Clockworks Down, and they did an issue of our publication on that. And I could comment in various ways. You mentioned one, and that is ultimately it'll all run out anyway. And secondly, that it's just too beautiful a place to destroy. That I think it's a moral question. Of you see these pictures of these immense trees, magnificent trees that have grown there for I don't know how many centuries, and with all the wildlife in it. They talk about BC Natural. That's the way they advertise in British Columbia to attract tourists, and they're destroying the glory of nature that's in their trust. Now, recently, the government did take some steps to stop some of it and to establish some new provincial parks there, which was a step in the right direction. But it's really not adequate. I'm sympathetic with the loggers, but I don't think anybody is guaranteed employment simply because they did it before. And I might have more sympathy for the loggers as individuals than with Macmillan Hotel, with the big corporations, which they don't care about the people, they don't care about the resource, they care about extracting profits and moving on to something else wherever they can make money. And it's true, as you know, that this has been a world issue, that people in Germany have been protesting against it, and European interests have refused to buy their products. So there must be some real moral force there.
Tell us about the Wilderness Conference that you were talking about in Seattle. What kinds of things are supposed to come from that, or who is invited to it, or what's the point of it?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's biennial or not, but we're going to have one this year. There was one 2 years ago. I spoke at that one, and I will speak at this one again. I think the emphasis on this one is on the national parks. It's called the Northwest Wilderness Conference. I think it's the first weekend in October. I'm going to find out for you, if I will. It's at the Mountaineers, which is downtown. Do you know that building? It's really accessible, and everybody can come. We'd love to have you come. David Brower will be there on Friday night. And are you a teacher?
Yes.
Well, you know, I think it'd be great to bring kids to hear some of these people, like David. To listen to David Brower, to listen to John Muir. You know, you don't get those opportunities, and just like the conference we're going to hold in Missoula on Labor Day with some of these people who were active 30 years ago, maybe the last time, you know, we'll have these kind of people together. So if you want, I'll be glad to get to them, yes.
We're new to Holden this year. What do you know, or can you tell us about the pollution that these piling mine?
Jim, can you tell us about that? Jim's working on that.
What's being done?
And Ken Zoll and somebody from the State Department of Ecology, it's too bad they didn't come over here.
Well, the Forest Service has a couple, $3 million that they've been using for the past 4 or 5 years as an effort to reclaim or reestablish established vegetation on the mine fillings. And this involved putting gravel on top of the surface, attending the cap of gravel. And that's gone a long ways to providing safe spots for plants to germinate and get started in their growth. And also we're working this some are unstabilizing the size floats, which are prone to wind and water erosion. As far as the pollution that runs off and so forth into the creek, that is an issue I'm not very well up on yet. I'm just a new employee here, started in May myself. And there's been extensive samplings done as far as the metal content and so forth. And some of the worst heavy metals that people usually think of, like lead and mercury and so forth, aren't present in any great quantities. The zinc is one that is. And these are metals that, in heavy enough concentrations, are toxic to plants and other animals. And it's so we're concerned about it, and one of the things we're doing is trying to establish vegetation on the side slopes. We're putting erosion blankets on the side slopes this fall. And that's about as far as I can tell. DPA is also instituting research up here to see if this area is going to mine tailings of would qualify as a Superfund site. And if they do find that it's going to be a Superfund site, then all bets are off as far as what's going to happen with our reclamation effort. They might decide to do something totally different in regards to reclaiming and restoring the area. So basically, that's all I know about it.
Well, I met this chap from the State Department of Ecology, and he said he was here to monitor air quality of the tailings, and the water quality is another factor. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some serious problems. We discussed it briefly yesterday. You know, at the time they had the mine going for 19 and 20 years, everybody thought it was the greatest thing in Washington State. And now we're paying the price for it. Yes, ma'am.
Have you been into Yosemite Park in the last few years?
Yes.
I'm appalled. But I think they've done a tremendous job to try to keep it, but it's just the number of people that have been in there. I went in there in 1938, but my family were quite active at the beginning of the century. They used to go in there in the wagons and camp.
Yeah.
But we're very ecology minded.
Yeah.
And
well,
it broke my heart when I walked in there a few years ago.
Well, I was down there. I've been down there. I've been down there several times in the last few years. And I was down there a few years ago, and here was a rally of Porsche automobiles.
Yeah, and boom boxes. You know, what does that do in the air?
Who needs 150 Porsche automobiles in this Sunday Valley?
It's
for play and the wonderful. See, John Muir, 1913, he objected to the introduction of automobiles in Yosemite. He said, good walkers can go anywhere in these sacred provinces. So Yosemite is typical of the crisis in our national parks through overuse and misuse and neglect and political influence derived from people who make a profit in more and more people going into the park.
Just numbers of people.
Well, there was an article in our Canadian papers about American parks, and particularly Yosemite and the things they're now doing to try and restrict use. And,
they've been trying to do that, but they've met with problems,
well, the Canadian parks are great. I think they're trying harder than we are to protect them.
As a matter of fact, in Banff and Yoho and another park in that area, the Glacier, I believe it's called, they're now charging a fee for backpackers, not day hikers, but backpackers to help so that they can spend more money on maintaining the area.
We're trying to do that here too. I'm not sure it's really the answer. I mean, then you make sure you get rich people only.
They're only charging like $2-3.
I know.
Not very much.
I was just in Eastern Canada. I was in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. I saw national parks there, and it was just wonderful to get to go.
They have beautiful parks up there. All I have to do is look down here and see what happened to the parks.
That's right.
Avoid it.
I think the Canadians are trying to do that.
We're hoping that everybody still believes there's snow once you cross the border in that way. We won't get the horns coming out.
Did you want to say something?
Me?
No. Did you want to say something?
Well, I just wanted to ask a question.
Sure.
What's the squaw man?
Squaw man? He was married to a squaw.
Oh, okay.
Any of the trappers or the men that came out?
Did you?
Okay. One of the reports.
Go ahead.
Jim?
Okay, well, the Forest Service is implementing something, in the process of implementing what's called ecosystem management. And in regards to a part of that is the attempt is going to be, apparently going to be an attempt to restore the natural role of wildfire in the environment. And a complement to that would be maybe doing some thinning to some overgrown forests that have grown too dense due to the exclusion of wildfires over the past 70, 80, 90 years. Yesterday on NPR, I was listening to a sort of a debate there between it presented two sides of the story, and the Boise National Forest chief was promoting it, and the director of the Northern Rocky Wildlife Alliance,
yeah,
he was expressing reservations about this whole thing. And, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, let's just review that briefly, and that is, part of the reason that we have fires, there will always be fires in these countries, in these areas. It's just always, just like we're talking about a floodplain, we're in a fireplain. There are going to be lightning strikes, there are going to be fires. There always have been, there always will be, no matter what is done. So, 75 years ago, we embarked on a program of fire protection, putting out fires instead of letting fires burn. So a lot of dead wood that should have gone up in flame is still in there, and it's ready to go. Now the Forest Service, which promoted Smokey the Bear and said we gotta put out fires, and made a big business out of fire protection, now tells us that we have to set fires. Not only set fires, but we need to log in there. The Forest Service, which has done some terrible things in clear-cut logging, and is blocked from logging on the west side as a consequence of lawsuits, the west side of the state, because of the spotted owl. Now says, well, we got all of these areas on the east side here and in the Rockies that are ready to go, so we better go in and do this so-called salvage logging to prevent fires. And they want to call that ecosystem management. But I have my grave reservations that they really understand what ecosystem management means. Because they go to these forestry schools, and I taught at one for 4 years, where they've taught a system of agronomy. That is, that anything that grows is a crop. That for human consumption. And so I would be very dubious about the official approach. That's my answer.
Doesn't the Forest Service get some of its money from the logging that is done, some of the management? I thought that there was some sort of tie-in.
Well, there is. You see what they do is when the chief of the Forest Service goes up to for the appropriations at the beginning of every year, the first thing he says is, we sold so many board feet of timber and we brought in so many millions of dollars to the Treasury. Without really having a valid system of bookkeeping to show that they really didn't bring in that much money, that they subsidized the industry. And now you see they've been caught by what they call the low-cost timber sales. So the Forest Service is having a hard time with its own identity.
Or with their own credibility. It's like the fox minding the hen house.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't trust that they will do the right thing anymore.
Steve.
Mike, two questions. One, on Thoreau's thinking of his civil disobedience, how did he relate that to his views on the environment, you know, his views on nature? And did his thinking, you know, opposing war, opposing slavery, did that carry through to other environmentalists such as John Muir?
No. And the second question is, I don't think that environmentalists in John Muir's case, that maybe it wasn't the issue with that. Probably some of them did. John Muir was friendly to animals. Alda Leopold, I didn't talk much about Alda Leopold. I might have talked about Alda Leopold. Alda Leopold was of the School of Wildlife, began in the School of Wildlife Management, that you got to kill animals to conserve them. That's the way they teach that, that wildlife is a commodity too, and a crop to be harvested. And although subsequently, he changed his thinking about that and certainly became broader in his approach to wildlife. But as far as talking about civil disobedience or issues of social justice, now there is a movement of environmental justice. They talk about that. I had a friend of mine who's a black, who's an official of the National Park Service, come to my school, and we talked about it in class. And one of the students said, you know, if we had racial justice, we wouldn't have to be concerned with environmental justice. Environmental groups have focused more on the environment than on other fields. Some of them do now see the connection, and some people who are in environmental groups are also peace groups or social justice groups. But we certainly need to do more to connect them together. Yes.
A couple things came to mind as you're talking of this overuse of the national parks we've been talking about. Does suggest something about the need for more such lands in this country for people to get that sort of experience.
Well, we certainly do need more such lands, and even though we got more people, we need more places for people to go. To protect, and we need those places where people live. We need more. I don't know. It's sort of like here at Holden Village. It's a great place, but I can see some waste of water, for example. It's not a big thing, but we need to eliminate waste in our way of life. We need to consume less and live better as a result of it. And if we consume less and live better as a result of it, we wouldn't need the resources that we're turning to these hillsides for, whether it's copper or coal or wood. But we've grown up in this country with abundance and a psychology of infinite resources. Now we need to face the hard fact that they are finite. That's only part of it. The other part of it is that we don't have a very equitable system of distribution of the goodies our way. You have some people who have too much and some people who don't have enough.
The truth of it is to have a more equitable system of dispersing a given like water, you need a more fascistic approach to have people say, I'm sorry, but you can't shower.
I do not agree with you. What we need to do is we need to have more people involved at the grassroots. We need more community structure, more community dialogue, more community leadership, more community service. I don't believe that federal law is the answer. It's community communities that can. And dealing with each other as brothers and sisters in a better way, and a willingness to stand up and be counted against the crowd and working with them until people who are our enemies become our partners. I believe it's possible. But for example, in my county, in Whatcom County, Washington State, we have a lot of people who are involved in the so-called YSU school. Just a lot of people. I mean, who are against public controls of many kinds. Except controls that benefit them, I suppose. But, and there may be big corporate interests behind them, but most of the people who are involved are average folks. They're not evil people. They're not mean people. They're not profiteers. They're not exploiters. And we need to deal with them as people. I always feel the same way about the radical right up here in Idaho that are against the government. Jeepers creepers, I see a lot that's wrong with the government too. Yes.
I read somewhere, I think it might have been in the National Park Association magazine, that the early indications were that attendance at our major national parks this year was down. So the trend seemed to be going down, and they were interpreting that as the public's reaction against the overcrowdedness.
I did not see those figures, but it could very well be. And sure, people are reading about this all the time. The parks are overcrowded, there's crime in the parks, there's vandalism. So that could very well be. But anyway, you can't trust the figures. I know you can't. Are you going to meet him for lunch?
Yeah.